One year after the genocide in Rwanda, journalist Philip Gurevich traveled to a country he described as blood-sodden and pillaged, with bands of orphans roaming the hills and women who'd been raped squatting in the ruins, its humanity betrayed, its infrastructure trashed, its economy gutted, its government improvised. And now Philip Gurevich, nearly 15 years later, returned to describe an almost unrecognizable Rwanda. His article about reconciliation and its limits appears in the May 4th issue of The New Yorker magazine. If you have a question about Rwanda today, if you've lived or traveled there, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Zap us an email, talk@npr.org, or join the conversation on our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. Philip Gurevich joins us now. In addition to his work for The New Yorker, he's editor of the Paris Review. He's at our bureau in New York. Nice to have you back on the program.
It's good to be with you, Neil.
And you say an unrecognizable place?
Well, on a kind of social organization level, it's a country that's very secure, where before it was a place plagued by physical insecurity. There is a kind of state control of the entire country, as opposed to a place where there are pockets of insurgency or rebellion or held by hostile forces. Basic way of life is improved massively. People are physically and economically much more comfortable than they were before, despite the fact that the majority of the people still live in what would have to be called almost grinding poverty. It's a far cry from what it was in the past. And it's a very well-organized country. I mean, it's a country that has a lot of firsts. It's the first country on earth with a parliament that is a majority women. It is a country where government officers have to be at their desks at 7 in the morning, where plastic bags are outlawed for reasons of environmentalism and litter control, where this is perhaps not astonishing to people in, say, the United States, but sub-Saharan Africa, it's fairly unique to come into a country where there are strict motorcycle helmet and safety belt laws that are strictly enforced. There are traffic cops all around the place where, when I was last there, there were soldiers in roadblocks. And above all, importantly, it's a country where a system of community justice was imposed to allow the country to adjudicate what the government claims was more than a million cases of essentially capital crimes related to the genocide of 1994, and to process those in a way that has allowed killers and survivors to live as they must live, intermingled at every level of society and every community within this country in a population of 10 million, which is basically a completely unprecedented social situation in human history.
And it is evident from reading your story that neither the killers nor the survivors are entirely reconciled to this.
Well, I think that that would be way too much to ask. So I don't find that shocking. What's shocking is the extent, or shocking is the wrong word, but what is astonishing is the extent to which there is a kind of coexistence. And I think coexistence is probably a more meaningful measure in terms of being realistic, and also in terms of what one, particularly as an outsider, can ask or expect of people, than reconciliation, which is a deeply private and sometimes spiritual, sometimes emotionally incredibly fraught and ricocheting matter for people who, in many cases, like the stories that I tell, you have a family which has lost 10, 12, 15, 20, 50 members in its extended form, living in a village next to, and by next to I mean 150 feet, 100 yards, house to house, from the people who killed them. And those people are walking down the street past them each day. And what does it mean for them to be reconciled? Well, the most basic thing is that they're not engaged in physical violence with one another. Mm-hmm. The next thing is that they're not tripping each other up in their ability to live a life like that, that they have accepted some basic idea that they must both be able to exist and continue and not pose a threat to one another. But then the question arises, well, if the killer asks for forgiveness, some of the survivors said to me, well, I might say, sure, you have my pardon, but it's basically superficial. We're both just going along with the government's policy, because if I don't know that he's really asking from deep within his heart and that he's really come around to some sense of regret and acknowledgement of his crime. Why should I even reach inside myself to try to forgive him for the deaths of my family? And I came to realize, talking to survivors and killers, that in many ways, what's being asked of survivors, killers have to go to jail for 10, 12, 15 years, often without trial for a long period before they get to trial. They're humiliated, I suppose, at some level for having to confess to their crimes. But the survivors are basically being asked for something much more. They're being asked to accept what should be unacceptable, the loss of all of these irreplaceable family members, which particularly in a rural peasant community also means your economic structure. And the killers are being given what they never imagined they'd get away with, which is their lives back. This is a country that had capital punishment. This is a country where what the killers told each other during the genocide was, we must kill them or they will kill us.
And there are also situations where people who have been recalcitrant and stayed in the Congo and were part of Hutu armies there, who come back and get, well, much better treatment in some respects than some of the people who were victims of the genocide.
Yes, I mean, this is one of the things that I really was struck by on going back now. When you hear about Rwanda from a distance, you often hear, well, the government these days, post-genocide, is composed mostly of members of the Tutsi minority. Therefore, it's often described as a minority government. And the implication is that it's exacting revenge through this rudimentary system of justice on the majority population. And it's always got the interests of the Tutsis at heart and not the Hutus. But the government is quite a bit more complex than that. And in its search for a solution to this very painfully and violently riven population, it is sought to create some kind of basic unity by equalizing people and by saying, we can't please everybody, and we're also not asking of you anything that we don't do. Hmm. And so the government itself, the army itself, the president, Paul Kagame, has always reached out to his ruthless enemies, his most fierce enemies, and said, if you want to stop fighting and surrender, you can be on my side. I'm not going to throw you in jail. I'm not going to prosecute you or persecute you. Come in and be in my government. And so he's been reintegrating these genocidal army from the Congo that's been part of the root cause of the Congo wars of the last dozen, 15 years that have really torn that country up next door. And he's brought generals in who ran bitter, bitter, bitter insurgencies that killed tens of thousands in Rwanda 10 years ago. They're now sitting as fully vested generals in his army. And these soldiers who return, they get put into a sort of re-education, reintegration camp, trained in the ways of civilian life, since many of them have more or less grown up in the jungle as bush fighters, and given several hundred dollars to start a business, which is, in fact, more than a lot of the children born of rapes during the genocide or other kinds of survivors ever receive in terms of material support.
Let's get some callers in on the conversation. Our guest is Philip Gurevich, author of The Life After, 15 Years After the Genocide in Rwanda, The Reconciliation Defies Expectation. That's published in the New Yorker's May 4th edition. 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. And let's begin with Colin. Colin with us from Denver.
Hi. I'm just curious how you feel the I recently read a op-ed in the New York Times that spoke about the Rwandan government's continuing reliance on mineral wealth in eastern DRC, and I'm a graduate student in international development and have spent a lot of time studying the conflict in the Congo, so I'm very curious how that reflects on the Rwandan government, and what steps are being done internationally to really cut down on the Rwandan government's role in the continuing conflict in eastern Congo. And I'll take the answer off the air.
Okay.
Thanks a lot.
DRC's Democratic Republic of the Congo. But, Philip, go ahead.
Yeah, the Rwandan government, well, I would say that the international efforts to do anything for the Congo or so have been pretty poor. There is the most expensive and the largest UN peacekeeping force in the world is in the Congo and has done dramatically little. It's been just terribly ineffectual to prevent any aspect of the conflict, really. It's reflected very poorly on the international involvement. And Rwanda's government has always taken the position that nobody else in the world cares about these things except those of us who are here. And the government of Rwanda invaded Congo the first time in 1996 and then again in 1998, and that time stayed for 5 years. So these wars have gone 96 to 2003. Rwanda was in there pretty much the whole time. And as the caller says, it was accused of sort of running a war of colonial exploitation of minerals there. There were no major mining operations on an industrial scale. It's still very rudimentary. Rwanda was in there dealing with a security problem, and that's what brought them in there. And what they always said was, we would much rather be dealing with this by dealing with a government of Congo that was responsive to our security concerns, and we would much rather be having trade. Because both of us need it, and paying taxes, and they've spent a great deal of diplomatic effort re-establishing the trade agreements that had existed but had fallen by the wayside with Congo to allow essentially a NAFTA-like trade bloc between them. And this January, Rwanda and the government of Congo, which had been widely reported, as the caller indicates, in the international press as being waging a proxy war. Those stories were simply false. They weren't waging a proxy war in the fall of last year. They were starting to negotiate how to deal with their common problems, that each of them had rebel movements in the Congo that were threatening their own stability. The Rwandans, the former genocidal fighters, the Congolese, a renegade Congolese Tutsi general who was basically fighting these genocidal fighters. And the Rwandans and the Congolese have now staged joint operations inside the Congo, which has massively shifted the political framework. It hasn't created instant security or peace or anything like that. The former genocidal forces are rampant and causing tremendous distress and suffering and killing and raping and pillaging and so forth in the Congo, even in the last few weeks. But what you have now is a situation where the two governments, rather than seeing their interests, and this is economic as well as military, mm-hmm. as essentially only one of them can prevail, have come to see that basically neither of them can prevail unless they're working together and unless they're looking at it that way. And that applies equally to the economic issues. Neither country can develop economically unless they have first security and then physical security and then economic cooperation between them. And this is the first time in really 15 years that a scenario for that and a common framework for understanding that to be the case is in place. It's very fragile. I don't want to remotely right. sound like it's overly hopeful, but it's there.
We're talking with Philip Gurevich about his article in The New Yorker magazine about his return to Rwanda almost 15 years after the genocide. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And Peter's with us calling from Madison, Wisconsin.
Hi.
Hi, Peter. Go ahead, please.
I don't have the context that your guest does in terms of my history in Rwanda, but I've been running a project there connected with coffee farming for the last 5 years. I distribute self-powered radios to farmers groups and then produce a weekly radio show. But what strikes me when I go and visit is that there's this constant parade of white SUVs that you see on the roads and on the streets of Kigali, and there's such a concentration of both government and non-government agencies, aid organizations in that country. And given the fact that there's 95% of the population exist as subsistence farmers with increased competition for land because of population issues and because of climate change, I'm wondering isn't there another tragedy just waiting to happen once these NGOs move on to the next World Crisis Center?
Philip?
Well, the government of Rwanda argues quite the opposite, that the best way to avert a catastrophe is to become aid independent rather than to keep depending on foreign aid. And they're about 50% of their budget's dependent on foreign aid. They've been promoting very aggressively kind of entrepreneurship and market development. And there's been bits of it. Until last year, the biggest American investment, for instance, was in tea. I'm talking about private sector investment, probably about $20 million in the tea business. This spring, an American company led a group of international investors to develop methane from Lake Kivu to electrify the country at a much higher percentage of electrification at about half the cost they're now paying for electricity. And that's a $300 million investment. And there's tourism is growing. There are plans afoot. And again, These things are happening at warp speed compared to the normal development of a country from the total annihilation you saw in 94, 95.
Yet your article does suggest that this is largely the creation of one man, the president, Paul Kagame. Do you fear that if he should leave the scene for whatever reason, this could prove fragile?
Of course it's fragile. I think that he would agree. When I asked him what would happen back in 2000 if he left the scene, he said, you know, it's not my problem. I won't be here. And I thought it wasn't a great answer. And when I asked him it again this time, he said, if I'm unable to leave by the end of my constitutional terms, which is 2017, and have institutions in place that allow for a transition and have people who have developed around me who are capable of taking this over, it's a failure. So even he is acknowledging pretty strongly, I would say, that it's quite fragile. But I think given the reality of how countries develop internally, it would be hard to imagine a scenario that was a whole lot more stable than this in terms of political institutions coming from the complete wipeout that it was a few years ago. I mean, I wrote a book about Rwanda that came out in 1998, and in it I had a line that was really kind of just a whimsical line. I said, you know, maybe you'll be reading this 5, 10, 15 years in the future, and maybe you'll be planning your next vacation there. And I was astonished when I arrived this time to see people arriving on vacation. So it's fragile, but it's moving in a direction that is far, far exceeds most people's expectations.
Philip Gurevich, co-author of The Ballad of Abu Ghraib, which comes out in paperback next week. His article on Rwanda is in the May 4th issue of The New Yorker, with us from our bureau in New York. Thanks very much for your time today.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on Talk of the Nation, polishing up your resume and other nips and tricks in the new job market. What did you do to get noticed? Email us, talk@npr.org. And remember to sign up for the Talk of the Nation newsletter. Find out what's coming up, what you missed, and our picks for the best of the week. Go to npr.org/email. Click on the box next to Talk of the Nation. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington.